Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer. Pride sponsors of Motorsports Formula One coverage. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by Motorsports Editor-at-Large, Simon Aaron, and Formula One engineer, Rob Smedley. Rob, a very warm welcome to the Motorsport offices here just off the Finchley Road. Thank you very much for joining us. We've got loads of readers' questions, lots to talk about. But tell me a little bit about what you're up to at the moment.
Lots of stuff, really. This 2019 was supposed to be a sabbatical for me before I then returned back into the teams after, you know, taking a year off from stopping at Williams in 2018, 2019 year off, 2020 back in. It hasn't been much of a sabbatical, to be honest. I've been really, really busy, but they're all exciting projects. I've kind of taken this time to. I suppose there's an altruistic element to it, definitely. But you know, I've benefited hugely from this sport, from motor racing for the last 25 years, and I'm really at the stage now where I'm trying to give a little bit back. So you know, the work that I've been doing with Formula One is trying to bring about a better understanding for the fan base, and with it trying to increase the fan base, you know, rather than just watching cars going round and round and round as we've produced Formula One TV shows for the last 50 years or whatever. It's just trying to help the public understand a little bit more about it. So I'm involved with that. We'll be further involved with that next year as well. And then got lots of little projects on the go from, you know, a lot of it'll all get announced quite soon, but some fairly major stuff going on in grassroots to try to get people involved. And believe it or not, you'll have to take a sharp intake of breath here, but try and democratise the grassroots of motor racing, because if I don't do it, then nobody else is.
You were talking there, just obviously you're trying to sort of help you know, Formula One get to new fans and things like that. Have you played a part in the regulation changes and things like that with Ross?
No, not really. I started in the early part of 2019. So that was already a matured body of work, if you like. It was almost finished. It was, or not finished, if you like, but certainly this first tranche of work was already done. Pat Simmons and his team have been running that program. What Ross has kind of tasked me with is to bring about some of the mystique that we as engineers probably understand a lot more than anybody else, and bring about explaining some of that to the fan base. But to do that, you've got to do that as we do it, you know, on a pit wall. You've got to do it with numbers and tools and facts, and try to bring about the really exciting bits of the race, which most of the time are completely hidden. You know, if you sit on a pit wall and you have the responsibility to make the right call for a pit stop and when to pit the car and what tyres to put on the car, believe me, it's a fairly exciting moment in your life. Because at that point, you know, you've got, depending on how big your team are, and the teams go from 700 to 1500 big, at that point you've got the whole of the team in your hands. You know, and there's other moments during the race where it's very exciting, and quite often I think what happens is this gets lost, because you'll be watching two cars going round and round a track. You know, the international feed shows the same thing, as I said, that it's shown for the last 50 years, and it's trying to somehow bring that those exciting moments of the race, you know, those really tactical moments, and bring them to life and suck people in. You know, we need to get the younger people involved in the sport, you know, the younger people to be watching the sport and to be engaged with it, first of all. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but you know, the bosses there at Formula One, they've got their work cut out, but I think they've got the right group of people there as well.
You talked about taking a year off before maybe venturing back into an engineering role, and then you said you've got all these other projects on the go. Does that mean that your return to Formula One engineering is on hold at present, or...?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, I had some pretty good talks with the teams. You know, I'm really lucky that there's interest, if you like. You know, that's a nice position to be in. But right now, I think there's a couple of things. The first is that personally, I'm getting more and more engaged with these other projects that I'm looking at. You know, not only, you know, the Formula One side, and you know, kind of the a governance level of the sport, if you like, rather than at that at a team level, but also these other projects, which are, you know, trying to give a little bit back to the community, trying to get people interested in the sport. You know, the sport is waning. If you want to know what the demographic looks like, look at me and look at Ed, because that's about your demographic, and it's about that wide. And there's a responsibility for some of us in the sport to try and grow that and get people more interested. So yes, to answer your question in a very long-winded way, Simon, it's on hold for the minute.
Yeah. Do you not think you'd grow the audience a bit with some more comedy radio messages? You were very good at that.
Yeah, I'm getting a bit old for that now, though, isn't it? You look like the oldest swinger in town.
Obviously, hopefully looking down a sort of a very bright future for Formula One. But in a way, we're lucky to have you, because you weren't interested in motorsport really at all. You love football, and then you went to the British Grand Prix in 87.
I can't remember the exact year. I would like to say 97 or even...
2007.
It was a couple of years back. Yeah, I went with my dad. My dad used to watch it. And actually, that's what I'm referring to when I say that the international feed hasn't really changed much since them days. It was just cars going around in circles, and I actually thought it looked dull as dishwater. I thought it looked awful. And I used to watch it, and I used to think, well, you know, he's the boss, he pays the bills, so I can't really turn the TV over. But then when I was about, I think I was about 11 or something like that, and he said to me, do you want to come to the British Grand Prix? So we went to the British Grand Prix, and we camped out. It's a true story. We camped out in the centre section behind. I think it was probably Alan Dockin's trucks, where the old runway was in the middle, the Formula 3 trucks, because he'd paid for the entry for a Thursday, and that's we couldn't afford the rest of the weekend. So I still owe Silverstone and the BRDC. The money for stealing into the British Grand Prix that year. I think it was 1988. So we'll do it at 1988 prices if I have to pay. Actually,
I think you snuck into the pits, and was that what changed it? Because obviously before then you didn't. Formula One was boring and not that interesting. So was it getting kind of up close to the cars, and
yeah,
that's what did it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can remember. It was I guess it was the Friday free practice. And I can remember walking into the circuit at the woodcut corner, and going between the grandstands and coming out onto this grass verge, and the Formula One practice was on, and it was just a visceral experience for me. It really was. You know, the one car I can really remember is the McLaren. That was the, you know, whatever cars come past first. The one that I can actually remember is that 1988 McLaren, and as it come past and the noise of it, and it just blew me away, and I thought, oh my God, what is this thing? You know what I mean? how have I missed this for the last 11 years? And yeah, then later on we kind of stole across into the when the session finished, we ran across the track, and then stole into the pits as well, and we were just about to get thrown out. By the security. It was a lot easier to get in and out than it was. We were just about to get thrown out, And this Leighton House mechanic came up, and he kind of said, "Oh no, the security guard was actually physically throwing us out." And he said, "No, they're my guests." We were like, "Oh, are we?" so we went in. I'd like to meet that guy. I think he'll be a few years older now, obviously. But he took me in, and he kind of just showed me and my dad the cars, and I was just blown away. I wanted to be a Formula One engineer from that point.
Because you then went on to, you worked at RS Karting on the weekends, then you did your mechanical engineering, and then after that you went to M Sport and did the sort of suspension and quite a lot of work on the RS Cosworth. You had quite an interesting sort of taxi ride, as it were, with one of the rally drivers there that sort of made you do a slight rethink of your calculations.
Yeah, that's a good story, that. I don't know whether that one's been told as many times as the other ones. Yeah, it was. So I was working for a guy called Mike Pilbeam, and I owe Mike an absolute debt of gratitude for giving me what was my first proper start, really, in motor racing. Mike taught me a lot. I mean, taught me engineering practices that I still use today. And we won the project it was the first Group A rally car. So it was the first World Rally car. So it was when Malcolm Wilson went from the Escort Group A to the World Rally Car. So Mike won the contract to design all the suspension and I think the roll cage and the engine installation, which I basically did all of that when I was about 22 years old. I wouldn't let me as a 22-year-old.
I was going to ask whether looking
loose
back,
on a dinky whether... toy, never mind the World Rally Car. So I started to sketch it out, and because I'd done a few touring cars at that point. And Mike had a look at it, and Mike's he's a real wily engineer, and he came out and he went, "Yeah, I don't think that's going to be strong enough." And I went, "Yeah, that's absolutely fine. I've done my calculations, I've stressed it all out." So I'll tell you what we'll do: we'll go up to Cockermouth, and we'll have a look at how these cars operate. I was used to track racing at that point, so we went up there. Kankinen was driving, and we did a test day, and I think Mike somehow wangled it with Malcolm that I would sit in with Juha Kankinen. So I sat in this car. And we did about 10 kilometres round the forest and come back. And as I jumped out of the car, I think I probably vomited first and then kind of looked at Mike and went, "Yeah, I better get back and do this, redo all that suspension."
But you carried on doing sort of passenger rides with some of the drivers you engineered, because didn't you do a passenger ride with Fernando at Spa?
Yeah.
And that, again, I think was obviously... Well, very helpful for you.
It was massively helpful because that was probably only a few years after that when I became Fernando's race engineer in what was the Benetton Junior team, and I think it was all born from that ride with Kankinen in the forest, and I got really quite into trying to understand how the driver, what his driving style was and what the nuances were, which you can never spot from the data. It's very, very difficult. I mean, we have more sensors now on the car, but back then it was pretty difficult to spot. And I think we'd done about two or three races with Fernando, and it was still quite difficult to understand him, first of all, because he didn't speak much English. So that was a bit of a barrier. But also because... it was just, it was just difficult for him to convey what he wanted from the car and how he drove the car. And so we went to Spa, and the guy who owned the team was a guy called Mickey Van Hool. And Mickey, he hired a BMW touring car. It was a rear-wheel drive touring car. I can't quite remember what model it was. And it had a passenger seat in, and I jumped in that with Fernando. And from that, I understood completely. It was just to sit next to him and just watch him drive and understand exactly what he wanted out of the car. And I've always been an engineer that is very sympathetic, I think, with the driving, with what the driver needs out of the car as well. There's a certain point where you've got to say, this is what it is, and you've got to drive around it. But I think there's always a lot you can do with a driver to get to the point where you've actually engineered the car around them rather than got them to change their driving style. And I still do it now. When I watch my boys go go-karting, and the kids in the team, and they've all got slightly different driving styles, and all the dads are like, "Oh, well, this is the way you have to set the car." And I say, no, you have to set the car to be sympathetic with how your son or daughter drives the car. So I've always been really quite into that.
You did some sports car stuff and the rally stuff with Mike Pilbeam. You did the touring car stuff with Williams. Then you got into Formula 3000 with, say, the Astra Amiga Benetton Junior team with Fernando. It was only a second season of car racing. How aware were you, how quickly, of how good he might be?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I think from the very first test we did.
When he turned up and no one knew who he was.
Yeah, when he turned up and no one knew.
And couldn't speak any English.
And couldn't speak any English, yeah. So he turned up at Barcelona with an old Ferrari, Niki Lauda's old mechanic from Ferrari called Emanuel Quoggi. And I don't know what's happened to Emanuel these days. And he kind of was the translator for Fernando. But there was also a little bit of Chinese whispers between Emanuel's, between what Fernando was saying and what I was hearing. And Adrian Campos, he turned up with Adrian Campos as well, who was then his manager. And I think, I can't remember all the details of the story as to how Fernando actually got in the car. But our number one driver at that point was a guy called Fabrice Wolfish, who I think had done quite well in Formula 3000 the year before. And he was going to be engineered by the team's chief engineer, a guy called Chris Murphy. So we were then on the lookout for the second driver, and somehow through the Benetton link and the Telefonica link, and Flavio Briatore, Fernando turns up on the doorstep, and I can't remember what they used to pay back in them days, but it was probably some nominal fee that he had to pay for the drive. And the team manager said, "Oh, your driver tomorrow is this young Spaniard called Fernando Alonso." So I went and had a chat with him and shook his hand, and you know, I was much younger at the time, obviously. He was a baby. I think he was either 17 or 18 or something like that. So we kind of got him ready, and we did a little bit of seat fit on the night. And forgive me, I can't remember who the driver the day before was. He got in the car, and what my job there that weekend was to evaluate the two or three drivers, or that week of testing in Barcelona was to evaluate these two or three drivers who we were going to see who would be the number two driver. And I was going to report back to Chris Murphy, who was the chief engineer, and tell him, you know, yeah, we found a suitable number two, can play shotgun to your number one superstar. You're guessing where this story's going. So we put him in the car, and we had some old knackered set of tyres on, and we had a benchmark, which we'd said to him, right, this is your benchmark, because this is what we did in qualifying this year with new tyres, blah, blah, blah. And we hadn't got anywhere close to that in the one or two days previous. And he jumped in the car with scrub tyres on, first time in a Formula 3000 car, and went about half a second quicker than that lap. And I thought, oh, this isn't right. and when you look at his lap times, you think, well, the track's gripped up or there's something wrong. When you look at his lap times, he's right at the top. And then we stuck another set on and another set of new tyres, and he immediately found the grip, which is a clear sign of an incredible talent of somebody that age. He immediately finds the new tyre grip, extracts all the grip out of it, and goes about a second and a half faster again. So... We used to have a fax in the truck back in them days. You didn't have mobile phones. So I had to phone back to base to Chris Murphy, and he said to me, you know Chris, don't
I? I do, yeah.
So he said, "How is he then, Robert? We found a driver."
He does sound a bit like that as well, yes.
And I said, "Well, we've had a couple of no-hopers in the car the last 2 days, and we've got another one here, Chris, as well, in this Fernando Alonso, but we'll take him for next year, and I'll play number two shotgun to you."
But when, because you obviously you then went on to engineer Felipe, but at one point obviously Felipe's teammate was Fernando at Ferrari. Was anything you knew of Fernando from those Formula 3000 days useful as Felipe's engineer? Because you must have known him a lot better than most of his kind of opposing engineers, I guess.
Yeah, well I guess so, a little bit. Just about how quick he was. You know, we kind of went through the same cycle with Felipe, with Fernando, as we had done with Michael. So with Michael, I think Felipe's number one priority was from the immediate outset in 2006 that he was going to beat Michael, and he had to beat Michael. And when I became his engineer, one of the key things that I was able to do for him was to kind of say, well, let's set our targets a little bit lower, because trying to beat I think he had 7 world championships at that point. In fact, yeah, he did have, he was 2006, was it? So expecting to beat your seven times world champion teammate in season one, bit of an ask. So why don't we just knock the targets down here and then we can start to chip away at it? And actually, it was undoubtedly the best way of dealing with that situation, you know, of setting the targets lower and then building up to it. But by the time Fernando stepped in the car, Felipe was already established as being, you know, he was vice world champion. He was 1 point away from it, and from being actual world champion, he was seriously quick. He was winning races. He was pole position. And when Fernando came back, that was then a little bit more difficult for him to kind of assimilate in his mind and think, right, well, I am going to take a step back and lower my targets to try to get near this guy. So Fernando's just a really, really difficult teammate to beat because you see it in Lewis now, it's the consistency. So there's times when you know, this year when you see flashes of brilliance from Valtteri, where he's clearly he's quicker than Lewis, there's no doubt about it, but to do that over 21 races and to do that, you know, over the 21 times five sessions or whatever it is during a weekend, that is a big ask. That is a big ask, and it's a big ask with Fernando as well, because he's just, even on his bad days, he's good.
The thing that always used to strike me looking at a race history chart at the end of a Grand Prix with Fernando and, you know, others as well, but just every single, you know, the lap times are so similar all the way from start to finish. If the car's supposed to be doing that, he's within a tenth of that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, whereas with Felipe, with all due respect to him, he's a great racer, you know, you'd get a bit of that, but then suddenly there'd be a, what's that? You know, his 4 tenths gone missing from somewhere. Then he'd get back to where he should be.
Yep.
And Montoya was the same as well. You know, lots and lots of brilliance, but just then these occasional little erratic peaks and troughs.
But I think that's the sign of a true great. The greats all do that. They'll just hit their marks every single lap. And the reason why they're doing that is the absolute key reason that makes them, you know, from a good racing driver to a really great one, is that they're doing it with 80% of capacity. So a really good, a really fast, you know, drivers, you know, even drivers who've become world champions, can, you know, hit those, you know, hit their targets for five laps and then less so for two laps. And that's because they're operating at 10 tenths. Whereas the really great drivers, you know, you listen to them in the car and they're hitting their targets, you know, 66 laps out of 66. But they've also got a lot of capacity to do other things. Which is why, you know, it's always the cream who comes to the top in the wet, because as soon as there's something to think about and they have to, you know, understand the conditions and understand how much grip there is and where the grip is and where the line is, it's those drivers who have that capacity who've been driving around at 85% and have another 15%, you know, when things get really, really tough, that they're the ones who always come out on top.
There's a question here from 122MR. It sounds like a private number plate, but just relating to Fernando. It's Mr. Smedley, do you believe that Alonso is a divisive figure who places crippling pressure upon his team? I've heard you answer similar questions before, but if you could please elaborate, I think many motorsport viewers would be intrigued. That might be Fernando actually calling in on the phone, yeah. Before you answer it.
Don't you say anything bad about me.
We'll ignore the phone ringing. On you go.
No, I don't think he's a divisive figure. I really like him. I really like him personally. I think he's a good guy. He is ruthless in his ambition to win. And of course he wants that to be him that wins. And he deserves it as well. I mean, his talent and his greatness, you know, I think allow him to behave, you know, very in a very self-centered way, and I think all great sportsmen are, to a certain extent, they have to be self-centered. You know, the nice guy is not always the guy that wins. So I do, you know, and if I can say he's non-divisive after sitting on the other side of the garage to him, I think that's a fairly resounding answer that he is probably non-divisive. You know, he wants what he wants. He understands what he wants in order that he can win and in order that he can execute upon on what he needs to do, and he will do absolutely everything in his power to be able to do that. But I think he rather than divisive, he can be actually quite a cohesive figure within the team, because he's one of those people like Michael, different personality, different way of doing things, but in the end brings about that cohesion of 700, 900, 1500 people all heading, you know, in one direction. And when you have somebody at the front of you know, in a leadership position, which the drivers have to be to a certain extent, who is fearless, like Fernando is utterly fearless about things, and also, you know, another characteristic of a great leader is that they are essentially an optimist as well. You know, and Fernando is both of them things. He would never go into a race thinking, I'm worried about this and I'm worried about that and how are we going to do it? He's like, you know, right, time's done now, right? Let's just get the car on the grid and I'm going to wring its neck and if we can nick this race win, we will do. And I've seen him do that lots of times in Ferrari, you know, and I think that's more, you know, it's much more cohesive than it is divisive. You know, having a car underneath you where you get in and he sees those opportunities and he's ruthless about them and he goes out and wins races for you, you know, all right, for the other driver and his team, it's not always nice, but for the overall good of the team, you know, Fernando's been great.
You work quite closely with Michael Schumacher as a test engineer at Ferrari. You work closely with Fernando, obviously, as his Formula 3000 engineer, and you worked against him from the opposite side of the Ferrari garage. But just the key, what are the key differences between Michael, if there are many, between Michael and Fernando, about the way they go about the job, or went about the job?
Well, I mean, they do have very different personalities. You know, Fernando is much more overtly ruthless and ambitious, which is not a bad thing, you know, because he's always someone who you know where he stands. Michael was probably much more of a... I would say Michael was more gracious in the way that he, you know, would always go round and thank each and every person in the team, almost, certainly all the test team, certainly all the racing team, and whenever he came to the factory, you know, he would make his rounds there after each and every win, you know, and it was always quite a heartfelt gratitude, you know. It wasn't something that he thought, well, I should do and then they'll keep giving me a better car. It was always a really heartfelt gratitude that he would go around, and a very, very humble gratitude as well, that you know, I'm just kind of the last bit of the jigsaw. It's you guys who are doing it all, because without you guys, you know, there's no way that I would be able to have all of these, you know, medals and accolades and all the rest of it. So he was you know, Michael, if anything, during his driving career, was probably a little bit less self-assured than Fernando. Fernando knew what he wanted. He would go out, he would get it, he would extract what he needed, and he would move on to the next thing. You know, what's the next thing? Never ever look back. Michael was probably just, you know, a slightly more showed a little bit more humility in the way that he went about it. But both of them were fairly ruthless, you know, and both of them, especially when you got the helmet on. You know, there's nobody more ruthless than Michael. Moments. Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because you did obviously a short spell at Jordan, and then you were sort of asked to stay on another year, but then you did go to Ferrari. Was that quite a big change for you? I mean, obviously, you know, putting aside the obvious Italian team, British team, because Ferrari was certainly that period so much more advanced, really, in so many ways. Was it a bit of a shock, or was it easily kind of?
It was a massive shock, I think. It was nice to have to have cut my teeth in Formula One with a smaller team, a midfield team, if you like, and understand, you know, the bigger picture about Formula One and how it worked and where the performance was and how to go about just doing Formula One as an engineer. Stepping into Ferrari was just a complete different planet. It was another planet, and you thought, you know, my initial thoughts were, you know, well, first of all, what have I been missing for all of this time in Formula One? But second, you know, there is a two-tier Formula One. It became very apparent in my first weeks there that there's a two-tier Formula One, and these I'm definitely now with the haves. And if you're going to do it properly, then this is the way to do it properly. And then you set about, you know, just as I've always done in any situation, is just absolutely absorbing and soaking up as much information and ways of doing things and ways of operating as you can. So the initial, you know, let's say 6 months, even a year, was just about that. It was just about soaking it up and understanding how it worked and understand how to operate in a team that size, you know, a team of 1,000 people rather than a team of 250 or 300, whatever we had at Jordan.
How was it working for Eddie? There's always a pause or a smile after I ask that question.
Different. Different. It's no different to when I see him now. The man's a lunatic, an utter lunatic. He's definitely got a screw loose in the nicest possible way, you know. And he's a pal and all the rest of it. But my God, is he slightly deranged, that man, you know. And it was exactly the same when I worked for him, you know. He's slightly erratic in his decision making, very, very passionate, absolutely loves the sport, you know, he absolutely adores it, loves probably more the wheeling and dealing and getting things over the line. But we had a lot of fun, you know. It was a good team, and we had a lot of fun, and we always there's a phrase that I really dislike, which is punching above your weight, or punching above our weight. And that was always Eddie's thing, that we were punching above our weight. I think that I don't think you can punch above your weight. I think you can punch at your weight, and then a lot of other people punch below their weight. And I think that's probably what we were doing with Jordan. We were hitting it, and we were getting it spot on. And that's it's a team that's had a lot of, you know, if you then fast forward through the annals of history, up to the, you know, recently with Force India, it's always a team that's done very well for the amount of money that it's spent. Consistently, so it's kind of like a culture that grew up there, but the man himself, oh God, there's some good stories there. There's lots
of
good stories.
Go on.
We've got plenty of time.
Honestly, I don't know whether he'll kill me because you can't get rid of him as well. I mean, you see him in public spaces, and he starts to, especially in airports and stuff. You know, you might be at a Grand Prix and you're kind of making your way through the airport, and in situations like that, unfortunately, people recognise you. And then Eddie comes up and makes, you know, the rest of the airport recognise you by just shouting spurious things which aren't true about you. It's just like, go in now, Eddie.
But, I mean, for all that, it is remarkable. If you look at the way Formula One is now and how difficult, almost impossible it is for a GP2 level or F2 level team to just step up. We saw what happened in 2010 when the new teams came in. Yeah, they all struggled. I mean, he came in 91 on a wing and a prayer, wheeling and dealing, as you say. But from that, and from the verge of bankruptcy every other weekend, he created a winning team.
He did,
in time. It's an amazing achievement.
Yeah, it is. No, you can't take anything away from him. And I personally think that Eddie could have had much more success in Formula One than he actually did. I think he could have got, you know, that team into the realms of McLaren. You know, it was his personal decision in the end because they spent an awful lot of money in those years, you know, that 98, 99 years to get where they needed to be. Relatively a lot of money, you know, not the money that the top teams were spending. And they took it to the top teams. You know, they were winning races. And I think in 99, were they third in the world championship?
Yeah, I mean, France was in contention for the title till late on, yeah.
Until very late on, exactly right. And I think Eddie, that's kind of where he wanted to get to. He wanted to get there, and he'd done that, and he'd kind of, you know, a boy from from Ireland, who'd come from nothing and had kind of got up there and was now part of the consignante of Formula One. And I think at that point he kind of thought, right, okay, that's it, that's enough, because this is something that can very easily now bankrupt me and all the wealth that he'd managed to accrue up to that point. You know, and it's his personal decision and good on him. But, you know, he kind of, as he backed away from the team, somewhat, it definitely lost its impetus. It needed him as a leader, because it was a team that had that plucky character and that wheeling and dealing and you know maximising every opportunity, and he was the poster boy of exactly all of those things.
I wanted to talk about Felipe quickly before, because I must get through some of the readers' questions. But you obviously, when you were first at Ferrari, you were working with Michael. How did the role come about, the role change to go to Felipe? Because it was at the beginning of the season, but it wasn't at the start of the season. I think it was three Grand Prix in or something like that, because you ride for the German Grand Prix engineering.
That's right, Felipe. Yeah.
So why the change then? How did that happen?
Well, what had happened was that when Felipe came into the came to Ferrari in the winter, then I actually stood in and deputised for the guy who was going to be his race engineer, because Gabriele Delicoli, because his wife was heavily pregnant, so he stayed back in Maranello and I went out to Bahrain and lots of other places and engineered Felipe, and we kind of hit it off at that point, and I thought, you know, I didn't really think anything else of it, but he was obviously happy with what I was doing. And then when Gabri came in, who's a great guy, he's a really good friend of mine, actually. He's in Audi now, and a very good engineer. You know, and this happens all the time. It's happened to me as well. Is that, you know, the two personalities clash, and you just can't, regardless of how good an engineer you are, if you don't have that, if you don't click as a pair of people, it's difficult that you're going to get on. And that's kind of what happened between Gabriele and Felipe. So around about after about four races or something like that, it all happened very quickly, actually. I was going to say the team principal, but he was actually called John Todd. We know that, don't you? My mind. We got that bit. John and Ross spoke to me and said, "Would I be interested in engineering Felipe?" And I said, well, why and when? And they said, well, when is, we're getting on a plane tomorrow and going to Nürburgring. And why? Because of the reasons that I've just explained. So I think I responded with something like, well, can I have a little think about it? Because I'm really enjoying my time on the test team. And I loved the test team. I would still be a test engineer now if I could be. And I said, well, can I have a little bit of think about it? And like John kind of leaned forward in his chair and he said, this is Ferrari, son. He said, we don't think about these things. It wasn't actually a question. I said, right, well, I better go home and get my passport then. So, and that's how it kind of ended up. That's how I ended up engineering him. And it was what I talked about before. It was getting there. It was, you know, that was really the first time I'd seen him in quite a while, because they'd disappeared off to Australia and then Bahrain and then wherever else. So I hadn't actually seen him for a few months, and so I rocked up there on a Thursday. He knew what was coming, so I went and just had a little chat with him, and he was just incredibly nervous. He was just so nervous, and you know, he just kept repeating to me that I'm going to get sacked, I've got to get better results, so I'm going to get sacked. And I said to him, well, you know, there's a high probability of that.
You know? Did that help?
Yeah, it did, because I mean, it was kind of given in context that there's a high probability of that, but here's the plan to go and try and stop that. And to be honest, the first thing we did, which is what I talked about earlier, was just say, look, what is it? What do you think you need to do this weekend? Well, I need to beat Michael. If I don't beat Michael, then you know, my weekend's finished. I said, no, we don't need to beat Michael. And in fact, it wouldn't be appreciated, because Michael is definitely going to be the one that's going to win the World Championship this year. So if you go out and you beat Michael, believe me, it's not going to be that highly appreciated within the team. Might be appreciated back in your hometown of Sao Paulo. Here in Ferrari, less so. So we kind of set about just having, you know, softer targets, and he went through the weekend. He kind of changed, you know, through Friday, and we got his car set up how we wanted it set up as well, which always helps. And he was really happy at the end of Friday. Saturday he qualified quite well, I can't remember, and Sunday he finished third, which is his first ever podium in Formula One. He finished third, and I can't remember the exact order. Michael won it, I know that, and he was third. And I always remember it's always a defining moment for me, because it, you know, Formula One is not the most generous of spirited business in the world. it can be quite mean at times. But, you know, and even when you're doing a good job, it's difficult to understand if you're doing a good job from your bosses. But I can remember jumping down from the pit wall and Ross, who's a big man, give me a big bear hug. And he said, and it was words to the effect of, I knew you'd be able to do it. You know, I knew you'd be able to turn this around. And it made me quite emotional at the time. And then we just went on and we just had, you know, it was kind of just in the same vein of just, right, we know you're quick, but he's all the things that you can't do. And we can help you with that. We can definitely help you with that. We can't help you to be quick. So that's the good bit, that you can do that. You know, that God or the big man above, whoever you believe in, gave you that talent. The rest of it we can work on. And we did. And we just started to chip away at it all.
How do you contend with being Felipe Massa and the team very much centered around Michael? You know, because he'd won 4 world championships with them. Or no, more than that, sorry. 5 world championships with them. It was very much his team, as you said. Don't go and meet him. No, it's not going to be appreciated. Actually, you will probably be fired then. but he did go on to win some races. Is that very difficult as an engineer and a driver, knowing that the team is really, you know, looking very much at the other side of the garage?
I think it's more so for the driver. But for me, I've never really found that particularly difficult, you know. And it was always very clear. I think with most people in life, you tend to get emotional about those things if it's not clear and it's done in some kind of, you know, surreptitious way. If things are clear from the outset that you know we need Felipe, if Michael's first, we need Felipe second, then you've got an objective job to do. You know, it's very, very clear what you need to do. And I personally feel no emotion about that whatsoever. I feel quite proud that you can go out and do that job. You know, you can't always be the bride. You've got to be the bridesmaid on some occasions in your career. But you know, and when you do that, you know also that your time will come, because there was a, you know, later on in his time at Ferrari, Kimi came, and again it was kind of a clear number one, but without all the status that Felipe, that Michael had. Sorry, but through sheer will and determination, Felipe was able to turn that round. So by 2008, the team had backed him. You know, was firmly behind him and wanted him to win the world championship because he was the better driver. There's no doubt about it that year. He was the better driver. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that you can waste your time on in life, and definitely life in Formula One. But politics and negative emotion and all the rest of it, there's too many other important things to get on with than worrying about, you know, who's the bride and who's the bridesmaid.
I have to say, I think one of the most gracious performances I ever witnessed in Formula One was Felipe Interlagos in 2008. Just the way he dealt with the devastating disappointment of the world championship slipping through his fingers just in those final few seconds of the season. I thought the way he handled that and the way he conducted himself on the podium, the way he spoke afterwards was, you know, I think he probably gained more out of that. I mean, he became more of a, I think he was respected probably more for that than he would have been if he'd won the world title.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think that would that extra point and a world championship have made any difference to his life? And him and I have had this conversation now. We've got a little bit older on many occasions. So would that have changed anything in his life whatsoever? You know, if he'd have gone on and then celebrated a world championship win, rather than had he gone on and you know, shown everybody how gracious, how magnanimous he was in that moment. I don't think so. And I think, I tend to agree with you, Simon, that it probably did him more good having gone through that very, very near miss, but come out of it probably a better human being. You know, and he's still a guy who's super grounded. You know, he's absolutely you know, got his feet on the ground. He's a very, very normal guy who realizes that he's been given a talent and he's, you know, he's used that, he's using it to the best of his ability.
How difficult was it for you dealing with the events of 2009 after his horrible accident and practice mishap in Hungary?
Yeah, really difficult, to be honest, and I questioned whether or not I wanted to carry on. It was a big question for me because, you know, you never set out. I'm not sure I'm the easiest person to work with or for, and I don't just, that's not my opinion, that's people who I've worked with and for. They say, you know, I can be quite a taskmaster at times. And at times, I mean, from about 7 in the morning till about 9 on the night. And then after that, then go home and relax a little bit. I think, quite honestly, you know, the backdrop there, what I'm trying to say is that I don't go out to make friends in Formula One or at work. But what happened with Felipe and I is it was just very natural, you know, that we became friends. And we became good friends. And you know, we are, you know, the best of friends, if you like. So when he had that accident, it was very difficult because it was much more personal than just a professional thing. And to watch that and to suddenly, you know, you're so emotionally attached to that person that when you see them, you know, they're almost killed at work, you have to question what you're doing. You know, and I did for quite a few weeks after that. I really had to do a lot of soul searching as to whether I wanted to continue to be involved in Formula One. And I think if it was probably someone who I was less emotionally attached to, someone who wasn't a friend, a dear friend, then you kind of just move on, you know. And that's not meant to sound, you know, ruthless and harsh and in any, or, you know, unempathetic in any way. It's just a reality, and when you're emotionally attached, as I was with to that situation, it was very difficult. And I did do a lot of soul searching over that summer, and you know, I think helped definitely by his speedy recovery. You know, he was young and he was super fit and all the rest of it, so he did make a speedy recovery. That definitely helped. That then I wanted to carry on, and it's a sport that, you know, even after all of that, it's a sport that I love. And I think if we'd have lost him that day, you know, perhaps the soul searching would have gone on a little bit longer, but I still would have come back to it because I'm just so passionate about it and just love it so much.
His recovery was sort of quite remarkable how quickly he was back out there, but I think you went to go and see him in the hospital and he wasn't sort of too bright when you went to go and see him.
Wasn't too bright. So first of all, he had a head like a beach ball. Which was you know, these shades of purple and black and blue. I've never seen anybody's head that big, and bless him, he was just a bit all over the place. So when we walked, so his younger brother Eduardo picked me up from the airport, because so I'd flown home, I think, when they'd taken him out of the coma, and then I'd gone home to Maranello to be with my wife for a couple of days, and then on the Thursday or Friday I flew back and he was actually out of intensive care and he was in his room, but he was super confused. I mean, I think at one point he wasn't really sure who I was, and then when he kind of, he said, oh yeah, you're the Ferrari guy, aren't you? And he was really keen on conveying to me that he was going to be in the car in the next race. And he was saying, you know, I've got like my mum here and my wife, and I think his wife was pregnant with Filipino, their son at the time. So his mum was there and his wife was there, and they were obviously, you know, fussing around him and saying, well, you're going to need 6 months out. And in his mind, I'm not sure we'd have been able to get a helmet big enough for him, but in his mind, he was going to be in the car in the next few days.
Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer. Proud sponsors of Motorsport's Formula One coverage.
When we sat down as a group and looked at the brief originally, foiling kind of jumped out as an option. Traditionally, hydrofoils on powerboats have just been static, and they've helped to increase the efficiency slightly. These not only do that, they're active, so they help control the roll and pitch of the boat and make the boat not only more comfortable, but but safer and easier to drive. We are on the cusp here, I think, of changing the direction of the boat industry. AFS works in conjunction with a reimagined hull concept. Low transfer immersion brings higher efficiencies at cruising speeds. Foil lift replaces transom volume, allowing top speeds to still be achieved. Foils automatically deploy and retract flush with the hull. The foils rake fore and aft, varying the angle of attack. Port and starboard foils are controlled independently. Onboard sensors and a dedicated processor calculate the optimum foil position 100 times per second. Foil position is actively controlled, reacting to the boat state, improving comfort, stability and safety, with modes selected by the skipper.
I read Simon's piece that he did with you, the lunch with, and there's a lovely bit in that about the 2008 Monaco pole lap. And Felipe, obviously, when you first started working with him, said, I'm just not very good at Monaco. But being an engineer, you obviously didn't quite accept that. Just tell us a little bit about that Monaco pole lap.
So it was, you've got to go back to a few years. It's 2006, really, and we went to Monaco, and we were getting quite unsung by that point. By the time we got to Monaco, I think we'd had a few half decent results. And he said, you know, he was a lot more relaxed than himself, and he said, look, I think we were going to be able to do this. You know, I think that I can see a path of us getting better and better. But one thing is, I can't drive around here. I'm just rubbish. good attitude, great positive ingoing attitude. So I said, fine. You know what I mean? It's kind of there's probably 18 races back then, so we're doing 17 out of 18 kind of thing. And then when we went there and we looked at it. Then, in fact, his lap times were pretty appalling. They were rubbish. But when you actually pieced it all together, which we were doing during the weekend, and you looked at it, you thought, he's not rubbish at all. He just can't put a lap together around here. In fact, if you take all the corners, if you really dig into the data and you go through it all and understand it all and you compare it to Michael, he was, you know, within, you know, a tiny margin of Michael's speed. So you think, right, well, it's not like that at all. You know, you've got it totally wrong. So when we come out of the Monaco weekend, we had a lot of soul searching and going through reports with him and going through data. And he kind of like got it. And we said, right, next year when we go there, we're going to have a better plan. So we went there the next year, and he was much more confident. He kind of said, yeah, well, you know, we'll see how it goes. But by the end of the weekend, he was much more confident. And I can't remember the result, but definitely in qualifying, he was, rather than being like a second or so off Kimi, he was like 2/10. And then for the next year, we kind of understood what to do with the car as well. So it was like we're not very quick. We had like a 3-year project of like actually getting it right in Monaco. So we went there the next year with a car, and he was just immediately on it straight away. And there was one bit that he couldn't get right, which is probably in your piece, Simon. There was one bit that he couldn't get right all the way through quali, and it was Sandoval. And the rest of it, he was just absolutely killing Kimi. But he couldn't get Sandoval right. And because he couldn't get Sandoval right, he wasn't getting Cassino right because he wasn't getting enough temperature in the tyres. And so we looked at it after the first qualifying, and he was just braking far too early. And we said to him, you're braking too early. You've got to brake later. This is as late as it will break. You know, this is as late as I can break, and if I don't, then I'm going to lock the fronts. I said, you won't lock the fronts. We can see. We can. I can tell you from looking at the data, and looking at mainly the slip angle and the yaw velocity, and just the general margin that we had of grip, of available grip. You're not going to lock the fronts. So we went through the first qualifying like that and the second qualifying, and he was kind of like inching forward by like 3 centimetres at a time and thinking that, you know, he was the bravest man on earth. And this is where I get quite difficult to work with sometimes. I kind of just lost my rag. So I took my radio off and went over to him just before Q3 and got hold of him and did a bit of effing and jeffing, and told him that in no uncertain terms, that what I would have expected from him in Sandoval at the very next lap, which was Q3. And you could see he just thought, you know, fuck you, nobody, I'm not having this, that he's talking to me like this. And when we talked about subsequently, what he was going to go out, he was going to go out and he's going to prove me wrong, because he was going to brake at Sandoval where I was telling him to and go straight on and you know, and break the car, and that was going to show me. And he went out and he stamped on the brake pedal about 25 meters later, and then thought, oh, fuck, it's gone in. Got around the corner and up the hill.
About 3/10 of where he'd been before, yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
And put it on pole.
Yeah, and put it on pole.
I mean, they're lovely. I mean, I remember the thing about that was him coming into the press conference room afterwards, and he was just looking absolutely bewildered, as though he didn't understand how that had just happened. I mean, it's his fault, but it was lovely because, I mean, the whole press room is a bit of a cynical place, as you know, and you know, the whole place, you know, applauding and clapping him, and he just looked completely. I mean, he looked ecstatic, but befuddled as well. It was lovely.
Now, just before we go on to the questions, I want to talk about Williams as well, but your kind of Ferrari relationship, I guess one of the lowest points was 2010, and Fernando is faster than you, that sort of infamous, well, now famous phrase. It's been talked about so much, but I just wanted to kind of hear from you, because really overnight, you were always known within the motor racing circle, and everyone knew who you were, what you did. But overnight, you were suddenly catapulted from that to everyone knowing who you were. I mean, you were in tabloids, you were in newspapers, everything. That must have been quite difficult.
It must have been a difficult call to make as well. It was the anniversary of the Hungarian accident as well, I think, wasn't it? Or more or less a year on. So it was, yeah. It was just difficult in every possible way.
Yeah, it was. And you know, if you could have your time again, would I change anything? I don't know. Did I behave impeccably on that day? No, absolutely not. Did we all, you know, as a team of, you know, that the senior members of the team, did any of us behave impeccably? No, absolutely not. But yeah, I think the actual incident is reasonably well known and well recognised. But you're quite right; it's a good point to pick up on, because it kind of, you know, I went from being, as you say, you know, people knew who I was within the motor racing fraternity, and you've kind of, you know. You will recognise within that demographic. But then kind of, I remember the next day my sister-in-law calling my wife and saying, oh my God, Robbie's on Radio 1, Radio 2, Radio 4. And I was on all the news bulletins and it just kind of, it went a bit crazy afterwards. And it wasn't a particularly nice time either, and I didn't want to. It wasn't something. It's not something that I've ever courted or wanted, if you like. Wanted, you know, the bit of reflected fame or whatever, you know, comes with this job. It's just something that I find a bit weird. But definitely after that, it kind of went into a little bit into overdrive, and I retreated as well because of that, because I didn't want to. I wanted to just get away from it. I didn't like it at all. It was something that I'm not. But you know, having to deal with that afterwards was quite hard, and it was quite hard for the team. It was quite hard for all of us in the team. You're right. There was you know, with it being the anniversary of Budapest when he'd had his accident, there was a lot of emotion attached to it, and you know, people are always going to take sides. So there was Fernando fans, and there was Felipe fans, and the world.
Like Formula One fans to take sides, isn't it?
It's never happened before.
All we need to do is mention Senna and Prost on our website, and the whole thing explodes. Yeah,
breaks the website. Yeah, so it was kind of there was a lot of fallout and a lot of aftermath, but you know what, I can remember at the time talking, you know, Jean Todt was already gone, and I did have a little bit of a conversation with him about it, and he was ever so good, and he said, look, it won't break you, it'll make you stronger. And he was dead right, you know, because I think after that, you know, you kind of get thick-skinned in Formula One, but I think after that, I just became all skin.
Right, we must ask some of these readers' questions. In no order at all, there's a guy here called Matt. Matt, thank you for using your real name. It might not be. I have two questions. Thanks for coming in. Why didn't Ferrari change the traffic light refueling system in 2008? Before the disaster of Singapore, as Valencia could have gotten Massa penalised for an unsafe release also. So there's that part. And then he's a big fan of yourself and Felipe. What do you think was his best race and also your best engineering performance race?
Oh, I tell you what, Matt gets his money's worth, doesn't he? Three questions. So why didn't we change the? It's a really good question, and I am not personally proud of that 2008 season, because I think we threw it away rather than McLaren winning it. And why did that happen? It's a good question and a valid question, and there's a lot of other, you know, technical questions along exactly the same lines that I ask myself all the time about 2008. And I think the reason was because we were going through a period of transition. You know, we'd had this massive amount of stability with Ross heading up the technical team, Nigel Stepney, you know, as the chief mechanic, you know, big figures like that who'd kind of guided the whole thing along. Ross went off on his sabbatical in 2007. Nigel, you know, famously fell out with the team and all the rest of it, and there was other big characters there where it kind of lost, we lost that stability that we'd had for so long in Ferrari, and with it, with losing that stability, there's things that fall through the cracks. So when you look at it, you know, Singapore was an absolute disaster. Would that have happened if Ross was still there? Probably not, because he would have picked up on the Valencia thing. That's a really good spot. You know, he would have picked up on Valencia and said, we need to make changes to that system. Would we have blown an engine up in Budapest? Yeah, possibly. You know, if Ross was there, possibly not, because we were pushing a little bit harder and taking less care of reliability and more just out and out performance. You know, would Felipe have spun in Malaysia and beached it on the curb when he was in second position and thrown away 8 points? Which is, you know, was a huge amount of points. If Ross was there, probably not, because he would have, you know, he probably would have got on the radio at some point and told him to, you know, just to get home in second. So basically, what I'm doing, Matt, in a very long winded way, is saying that it's Ross's fault. Ross, don't sack me.
Then the second part of his question was Felipe's best race and your best race engineering performance.
I've honestly got so his best race, without a doubt, without a shadow of a doubt, was the 2008 Brazilian Grand Prix. And it wasn't just that 2 hours on the Sunday afternoon either. It was kind of the whole weekend where he was just absolutely untouchable, impeccable. You know, it was Lewis was a different driver back then. He was a younger driver, and he obviously didn't have the wherewithal that he's got now. But definitely, we went there knowing that it was kind of mission impossible. And what we were going to do, the only way that we were going to make it mission possible was just by putting a massive amount of pressure on them. And he did that. You know, he was totally relaxed all weekend. He was visibly relaxed, even though he may not have been visibly relaxed on the inside. And we went out and we were fastest in all the practice sessions. We were fastest in qualifying. You know, Lewis was back in fifth or sixth or something like that during the race. It was a very, very difficult race. It was a difficult race to call as well from a race engineering point of view, because it was wet, dry, it was damp, you know, intermediate, then full wet, then it was back to slick. And he was absolutely impeccable all the way through. And we got all the calls right as well all the way through, you know, and it's very seldom you watch any Grand Prix and you dissect the calls. Even with Mercedes now, who I would rate as a great team, they are a great team, but you watch their calls throughout a Grand Prix, they won't get every single call right. For you to get 100% of the calls right during a Grand Prix is something quite special. So maybe that one, maybe that one is my best performance as a race engineer as well.
We've got one here from Emily. This might be interesting in light of what you've been doing over the last year. What are your views on the 2021 regulations? Because from what I hear, the initial thought was great, but they have been somewhat diluted since.
No, I don't think so. I think that where we've got to now, they will get diluted once they're handed over to the teams. But I personally think that they're a really good step forward. You know, the biggest problem that we've got in Formula One in terms of the close racing, in terms of that wheel-to-wheel racing, is the fact that the cars have an outwashing wake, and so the car behind is heavily affected. So within when you're about half a second behind, which is about the distance that you need, you know, for this wheel to wheel or to affect the pass. When you're about half a second behind, the car behind loses around about 40% of its downforce. So it's kind of goes from a Formula One car to a Formula Two car. So it's very, very difficult then for the driver behind to follow closely and to make that work.
We've got a car alarm going on.
Someone's nicking Alan's car, and I can actually see Alan walking to the window. Yeah. He's quite precious about his car. There's a small part of me that desperately hopes that
because any pin drop when you're doing TV and the sound engineer is usually he's vomited all over the carpet and he's just not happy. I thought that's what Alan was interested
no,
in.
No.
Alan's just interested in his car.
Doesn't care about this.
Yeah. Is that your Lambo outside? My son was well impressed with it. Looks impressed now, doesn't he, on his iPhone.
So we've got time for a couple more questions. So SXS is the name of the person. Got to be careful how I say that. He's or she has written in a whole kind of essay, so I'm afraid we're only going to be able to take a fifth of what we got here. One of them is, when working with drivers, how aware do you think they are of the difference between what feels subjectively fast and what is actually fast on the stopwatch? With being I'm a really rubbish amateur racer, I'll go out and think, God, that was really good. And then I come in and I look at the time machine and I'm like, oh, no, it wasn't. So it's obviously on a different level to that, but I can see where he's or she's coming from.
Right. So I think that we're so objectively and data driven now, and that's pushed so far into the driver's psyche as well, that I think they have a really good feeling, especially Formula One drivers, because they've done it for so long, of what feels good and what feels bad. But the other, you know, the big cheat that they've got is it tells them, you know, how they're doing on their steering wheel. So on their, they'll have a reference lap, and as they, you know, as they're completing whatever lap it is, that the lap that they're on will be giving them a time feedback with reference to their fastest lap, so they'll know whether they're a tenth up or a tenth down or whatever. And I guess that having that type of tool set teaches them to be quite objective about things. So when they, you know, when they get a subjective feeling of a corner that feels fast, then they back that up with the stopwatch, with an instantaneous stopwatch which is on their steering wheel. And so you kind of get to feel, you know, very, very quickly as to what's good and what's bad.
Simon, I'll hand over to you for the last question, but we've got one here from Boris. I don't think Boris Johnson, but it is quite direct, so maybe. Hi, Rob. Is Claire Williams in over her head? Or if that's too rhetorical, could someone like Toto Wolff turn things around at Williams, or is their F1 team past the point of no return? Obviously, you spent some very successful years at Williams and scored plenty of podiums with Felipe and things like that. What's happened? Is the light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, there's always light at the end of the tunnel, 100%. You know, there's you know, Claire herself, you know, when I chat to her, she understands that, you know, that things aren't great. That's a bit of an understatement. And you know that they need to turn it around. Now, doing that, saying that and doing that are two very, very different things. It's a difficult job. You know, the issue that everybody's facing at Williams now is that even, you know, the next worst team is still a very, very good team. I can't remember who came ninth in the World Championship this year.
Don't test us like that.
Ask me a question about 1974 or somewhere, much easier.
Formula Ford or Formula 3000, anything from Formula 3000.
Yeah, but whoever it was, and forgive my knowledge, it was a team that still had a handful of points, and it was a team that was still a second faster than Williams. You've got to, you know, when you're in that situation, you can't concentrate on any one thing, because it's never one thing. It will be an absolute myriad of different things, and there's no silver bullet, and you've just got to look at right across your operation, you know, from technical all the way to marketing, and to make sure that no stone is left unturned, you know, and go through your business and understand what it is, you know, where are the big ticket items, what do I need to do, who do I need to, you know, where do I need to strengthen, and just start getting on with it, you know, and have a plan. That's the main thing in life, you know, not just in Formula One, but in life. Have a strategic vision of what you're trying to do. So that's where, what, you know, if my advice to Williams would be exactly that, you know, have a plan and start to action that plan.
Simon, sorry, the last question to you.
Okay, it's very, very, very kind of you. Going back to pet subject, Felipe Massa, he's still running competitively now in Formula E, and he had some very strong races post Budapest 2009. Was he the same driver 100% after the accident that he'd been beforehand?
Yeah, technically, yeah. Yeah, technically and speed-wise, definitely. He got a teammate that was just too difficult to handle. The dynamic of the team had changed. You know, he stepped out of a team, or no, he didn't step out of a team. It's true. You know, 2008 was a fantastic year for him. 2009, the car was a bit of a pig, but he was still...
He was doing better than Kimi until the accident, yeah.
But he was doing better than Kimi. He was the one who was on top of everything. Until the accident, and then what happened was he had his accident, he went away for 6 months, he came back, and the team dynamic had completely changed because Fernando had come into the team and started to galvanise the whole thing around him. You know, Fernando has the talent and the consistency to be able to pull that off. And so it was, you know, Felipe was not only returning with all of this doubt, you know, and all of this, you know, external doubt as to, you know, whether he was going to be able to do it or not, but then he'd stepped into a different dynamic, and it was quite difficult for him. So 100% he was, you know, I was at those initial tests when he got into a 2006 car or 2007 car, I can't remember what it was, and practiced in Fiorano, then in Barcelona. And 100%, you know, you could tell just by looking at the data and looking at the lap times that he was knocking out then. There was nothing wrong with him. Nothing had changed. Absolutely nothing had changed. But what changed was it became psychologically more difficult for him to handle Fernando within that team.
I mean, he out-qualified him in Bahrain first time out at the start of 2010. But then Ferdi did him at the first, or through turns one and two. And then that seemed to be quite a telling moment to me.
It was a defining moment, definitely, because it was absolutely typical of you know, everything that's brilliant about Fernando, and everything that's not brilliant about Fernando is that he came through as his teammate, he bashed wheels with him, and there's your message. You know, if you want a clear message of who's going to win this battle, there it is right there. And that obviously took Felipe back. You know, he was taken aback by that, as a few of us were. We were kind of like, wow, that was quite aggressive. You know, that could have been two cars out. It wasn't, and Fernando went on. I think did he win that race?
He did. Vettel's car broke, and he won. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And that was a little bit. You know, that started off Felipe thinking about, you know, how difficult Fernando was going to be to handle. I think in Australia, was it Australia which was the first race? Or was Bahrain?
Yeah, Bahrain was the first race.
So Australia must have been the second race, and then you know, he then got some team orders as well to let Fernando through, which he didn't at the time, you know, and it kind of just started and went on from there. To answer the original question, there was absolutely nothing changed with Felipe apart from the fact that he stepped into a much more difficult situation than the one that he stepped out of.
Rob, I'm very wary that we've run over, way over time, which is a testament to how great it's been. So thank you.
Thank you.
This time of the year, just before Christmas, thank you so much for sparing so much of your time and for putting up with us too. No easy task. Simon, thank you very much for joining in, and this time getting your facts right. Very kind. Thank you also to Alan for recording it all. We will be back next year for loads more motorsport podcasts. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye for now. Princess Yachts, the UK's leading luxury yacht manufacturer. Proud sponsors of Motorsport's Formula One coverage.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.